powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right, you guys, happy Thursday. As a reminder, just like every single Thursday, it's going to be a short show for Jake and I. We have the huddle coming up at noon. Dave Wyman going to join us, and we're going to have Seahawks guests. We're going to take a look across enemy lines with John DeShazier, reporter for the New Orleans Saints. Now, spoiler, we already did talk to him, so we got a ton of fun insight into this team. And I have to say something that might be offensive, but I don't mean it to be offensive. His accent was the best.
It was fantastic.
Like, I think when people talk about Southern accents, especially here in Seattle, people think they're making fun of them, but I'm not.
Yeah,
I really
like
was
Louisiana
like,
accent.
Have an entire... If he just read an audiobook of, I don't even know, like an instruction manual for a vacuum,
now,
I would
now,
listen to
be
to
clear, it.
It
wasn't, I don't want to set people up, because immediately when you hear that, you think of Ed Ogeron, or, you know,
I'm Ed Ogeron.
Yeah, you know, hardcore Southern Bayou.
No. It was like a smooth.
Yeah, smooth Southern accent.
I imagine, yeah. But like a very, like a hello.
Yeah.
John DeShazier.
Yeah, it was.
It wasn't that.
It was very slick.
Stacey,
we
that.
Don't need to go down this road with your accents again.
It was much smoother than mine.
But it was fantastic.
Curtis, actually, I'm glad that you say that. Jake, yesterday, Jake and I did a wonderful interview with a podcast, the Larshcast, up in Vancouver. And they're big Canucks fans, so we didn't get a preview of this upcoming Kraken game, but we had to say five things people don't know about one another. So one of mine was when Jake got suspended for creating a counterfeit parking pass, which to this day is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life.
It worked so well until it didn't.
How long did it work, Jake?
Honestly, it worked. No, it worked a long time.
It worked,
if my memory serves me correctly, I didn't get busted until the middle of April?
Considering
that year?
I am not confident you know how to work the printer here. I am shocked that you were.
Well, I didn't do it myself. I had somebody else do it for
me.
Oh,
an accomplice.
Yes.
Guy met in a parking garage.
That's exactly
right. Trench coat.
That's
Jake's,
right.
Jake's on mine was that my British accent is awful. And I was offended. So speaking of accents, I think that you'll be treated to a much better accent than my British accent.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Also revealed that Stacey thinks that people are poisoning her coffee.
I don't think they're poisoning me. I just think there's a lot of bubbles in the office coffee. What are we talking about? We're changing gears here. All right. Yesterday, speaking of John DeShazier, speaking of the Saints, he actually mentioned the 2017 draft class during our conversation, and that is fitting because yesterday we were talking about kind of everything that these two teams, the Saints and Seahawks, have in common. And they have quite a bit in common. They're teams that have been very successful for a very long time. Obviously, the Saints heading into their first season in a long while without Drew Brees. But prior to him leaving, you had a head coach quarterback tandem that had been there for many, many, many years, just like in Seattle, where you've had Carroll and Wilson since 2012. You have two teams that are kind of perennial contenders in the NFC. And also, and this isn't as fun, two teams that were able to capitalize on it like once and weren't able to get back again due to a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. Sometimes bad luck, sometimes injuries, and sometimes mistakes that were self-inflicted. But were only able to get there once with just a fantastic tandem. Now, Russell Wilson's still in Seattle. Pete Carroll's still in Seattle. And so that window hasn't shut yet. Although this season is struggling, and we'll get to that later. But for all that they have in common, there are two key differences. And I think that they are differences that Seattle can turn to and learn from, in my opinion. And so let's start with the draft. And let's start with one of those key differences, because that is one thing, and props to Curtis Rogers for pointing this out the other day, that these two teams have done differently.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle had a fantastic, one of the best ever in modern NFL history drafts in 2012. And leading into 2011 as well. I'll throw that in there. But 2012 was just spectacular. And since then, they haven't been able to replicate that. Now, that makes sense, because that would make you the best NFL franchise ever if you were able to replicate that year after year. But I think that what the Saints were able to do, particularly in 2017, but with a few picks from other drafts, is kind of replenish that talent pool.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something the Seahawks have struggled to do.
They have. And you look at 2017 very specifically. 2016, before that, Michael Thomas, Sheldon Rankins. You look at 2017, Marshawn Lattimore, Ryan Ramczyk, who's one of the best right tackles in the game, Marcus Williams, Alvin Kamara, Alex Anzalone. He was a contributor for them. He was a guy that played significant snaps for them for a couple years, didn't remain with them, but was a good starter. And then you had Trey Hendrickson, who signed with the Cincinnati Bengals. He had 5.5 sacks, but he had over 10 sacks. I think he finished with close to 15 last year.
Yeah, he was incredible.
Yeah, he was fantastic, right? So you get these guys contributing at an extremely high level for you, and that draft really helped replenish the Saints and replenish their defense and replenish their identity and really get themselves back to the top, and then you just keep adding. And it doesn't mean you hit on every pick, but so far what they've been able to do is they've been able to find good contributors, good solid starters for them, one to two to three guys every single draft up until, you know, now up until 2021. You look at 2021, and it already looks like a good draft for them because they're getting contribution from Peyton Turner, Pete Werner, and Paulson Adebo. All three of those guys are playing for this defense right now and doing a pretty good job. So that has been a big difference for the Saints as they've transitioned, as they've had to rebuild and remold. And when it came to the Seahawks in 2017 and you know, obviously before, but really 2017 being the mark of what's affected this team now, they have found guys sprinkled here and there, but they have not found A, stars, and B, enough solid role players that are starting for you, and that has been the major struggle for the Seattle Seahawks up to this point, in my opinion.
Yeah, in my mind, it is not fair necessarily to compare a team like Tampa Bay that didn't make the playoffs from 2007 to 20. It is not fair to compare a draft history for Tampa Bay to a team like Seattle, who made the playoffs every year except for one during that time, and so we're subsequently choosing much lower. That's why I think it's much more fascinating to look at the draft success of Pittsburgh, Kansas City, New England, I'll throw New Orleans in there as well, teams that have far more often than not been winning franchises and been contenders. And so what you're looking at instead of pick number five, or you're not looking at San Francisco, oh, congrats, you got Nick Bosa. I think the Seahawks could have figured that one out too. You're looking at teams that, you know, pick 47 overall took Michael Thomas, or at pick, 48 overall took their current starting center back in 2019, Eric McCoy, their current starting left guard, right guard, I think, Cesar Ruiz, at 24 overall. And so you're looking at picks that are a little bit lower where you can think like, okay, no, the Seahawks did pass on that. For instance, we were talking about Derrick Henry yesterday. Derrick Henry was drafted after Jermaine Ifedi. And, you know, it's one thing, hindsight is 2020. You look at that draft and you might say, okay, Seattle needed offensive line help. They might have thought at the time they didn't necessarily need a running back where they could have passed on that, right? Like, it's a forgivable offense in the moment. but with hindsight in mind, it's pretty tough considering what Ifedi became for Seattle and what Henry has become for Tennessee. But I think that it is fair to say that John Schneider and Pete Carroll have, on the one hand, had a fantastic draft class in 2012 and have made some fantastic picks. DK Metcalf, finding Chris Carson in the seventh round, drafting Frank Clark, who worked out for them, had 14 sacks for them before they traded him for a first-round pick. So, Tyler Lockett, that's another great pick for them. So they have made good picks, but they haven't been able to really replenish since in the way that the Saints have.
Right. They have found, and I think that's important, it's not knocking everything that they've done, because they've made good picks and found good players, but in its totality, it takes a toll. In its totality, it's hard to put together a roster when you're not replenishing your starting, you know, your starting rotation with guys that can really contribute. LJ Collier, guess what? LJ Collier, in my opinion, would be a success for this team if he was. I don't even care if he was a superstar, but if he was an active contributor to this team, I could live with that. But he's not. He's healthy scratch. He's a guy that they don't even want to see on the field, right? So it puts you in a bind. And the reason why that ends up catching up with you is we talk about the cap, we talk about offseason additions, and what do we credit the Seahawks for doing? How they handle the offseason. They are a frugal team that doesn't overpay. They don't overextend themselves in free agency. Well, part of the reason why they have to be frugal is because they have to spread their money out, not because of Russell Wilson necessarily, but because they have to spread their money out to fill their roster with starters. So then you have to go with average to, you know, below average guys or guys that are on the tail end of their career each and every single year to find a steal, because you're having to spread your money out because you're trying to fill so many holes. You're trying to patchwork so many different things. And I credit the Seahawks for being able to do that, where they're able to win, you know, 10 plus games for how many years they've been doing this. But it takes a toll, and it doesn't help you get to that next step. If you're able to fill this with the draft and you're able to fill more complete starters and fill more holes through the draft, now you can be more aggressive with one or two big signings in free agency. And so it kind of all comes together from that aspect. So that's that to me was number one in terms of the difference between the Saints and the Seahawks, as you just look at from 2017 to 2021.
Well, and one of the keys to getting, in my mind, a Super Bowl squad is having phenomenal players who are just these young, incredibly physically gifted, smart players that are on rookie deals. Like, that is like one of the common denominators of a lot of these teams that get there, is like you have some guys that you've spent money on in free agency, but you have a lot of bargains. You have a lot of really great contributors that are either on rookie deals or guys that you've struck gold in free agency with. And that is one of the common denominators to me with some of these Super Bowl teams. And the Seahawks, with one of those, have not been able to find that. We only have a minute or so here for the final one, so I want to jump into it later. But you talked about the second difference, in addition to drafting, being a quarterback and a head coach that had the same philosophy.
Yeah. And there's a whole lot to get into that conversation. But, you know, I would say that, you know, as we're running up on the clock here, number two, and I don't think this is a small number two, is that, you know, head coach and quarterback are philosophically aligned. So you're able to have this run of success. And even during the 8-8 years that the Saints had with Sean Payton and Drew Brees, there was never any controversy. There was never any moment where you felt like, man, is this organization being pulled in different directions? Is everybody on the same page? Is everybody philosophically aligned? And I think that part of it's important, because right here in Seattle right now, I would say specifically over the last two seasons, you know, that we know publicly, could be even longer than this, is that it has not been that way. And so when you have a head coach and you have a franchise quarterback that see things differently and want to try and go about this differently, it can be difficult. And it's difficult also to build and construct a roster where you're trying to serve two masters, right? You're trying to serve two sides of this, and you're never really truly building in and going all in on one specific philosophy to bring this all together.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Advanced Hair Restoration. Right now, it's time for Headline Rewrites.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Headline Rewrites.
Presented by Tila Mortgage.
The real story behind the headlines in today's news with Jake and Stacey.
Headline number one, we got the news right as our show was ending yesterday, but the Seahawks have claimed former UW and Colts quarterback Jacob Eason. What's the real headline?
A former UW quarterback with a big arm who didn't work out for an AFC South team? Fans have never seen anything like this before.
Come on. I'm pumped that Skinny's coming back. I'm pumped that Skinny's here in Washington.
Why? What's he going to do
home
for this team?
It's a hometown guy.
He's not good. He was given every chance to be the backup
looking,
in Indy.
Are you looking for Jacob Eason to be the starter?
No, I'm saying, like, okay, what's he going to do? Is he even going to get the backup role? Because he didn't get that in Indy.
No, he didn't. So he's got a lot to prove. He's in, and you're not expecting Jacob Eason to come in here from day one and compete for a starting job, unless I'm missing something. But you take a chance on somebody like this, and you see what he has. And if he is able to grow and develop within your program, great, because he's extremely talented. If he's not, what harm has this done? Absolutely nothing. So I view this as something that isn't solidified. I think that Jacob Eason has to come in here and he has to earn it. He has to show that he can come in here and learn the playbook, that he can come in here not only and show his talent on the field, but that he can be somebody that, with some of the question marks that he had in Indy, that he can be a different person here in Seattle. And sometimes that's what you need. You need change. And I'm not saying that Jacob Eason is going to be the greatest signing off of the waiver claim. That's not what I'm saying. But it is exciting to have a local kid here back, someone that played at University of Washington, a familiar face. And we'll see what he grows into because he's extremely talented. And the Seahawks, the only thing that you could say is that the Seahawks being 2-4, they're higher on the waiver wire claim. In most situations, they wouldn't have a chance to grab somebody like Jacob Eason off the waiver wire, and we'll see what comes of it.
And, you know, higher on the waiver wire claim, and they're going to have a higher first-round draft. Oh no. Curtis, go ahead with headline
Stacey.
Number two.
Headline rewrites.
How do you got to do that?
Yeah, jeez. Well, we're not going to feel any better here because headline number two, the Astros have a 3-2 series lead on the Red Sox and everything's awful. What's the real headline?
This time, it wasn't just the Houston Astros who saw it coming.
Come on.
We all knew the Astros would be here. We
no!
all knew.
Dang it.
We
the
all
Red
knew
Sox,
this would happen. Because real, no, Jake, real life is not Air Bud. Real life is not a feel-good Little League movie.
What are you talking
real
about?
Life
the
is horrible where the rich
it.
Get richer and get ahead. And the rest of us fail.
Get out of here. Get out
of
here.
Of course.
The Red Sox.
Of course the Houston Astros are still in this and going to the World Series probably. Of course. Of course it was the Dodgers and the Braves.
The Red Sox smoked the Astros the two times that they won. So, this just bothers me that I don't know if I'm going to boycott the World Series or not. I'm still
going to watch every game.
No, I'm not. If the Braves are in there, I'm watching every game because I'm rooting.
Our Atlanta Braves.
Yes,
our Atlanta Braves. We've always said that.
You are rooting for the evil
No,
empire.
That's not. No.
Yes,
I have
are.
Never been an Astros fan in
you
my
are.
Life.
You are.
No.
With the Fighting Freddie Freemans, that will be the only way that I am in this game. Outside of that, yeah, you can. I'm not interested in the Houston Astros
Everyone
facing the Dodgers.
Knows I have been a lifelong Braves fan and a lifelong Arizona Cardinals fan, and that a fandom has never wavered. A
lot of overlap in those fan bases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Arizona Cardinals and Atlanta Braves.
Deep connections there.
Headline rewrites.
Headline number three. Rumors swirling yesterday. John McClain of the Houston Chronicle writing about this, about a potential trade that would send Deshaun Watson from the Texans to the Miami Dolphins. Potentially some other teams may be involved as well. What is the real headline?
Breaking! Team that hasn't had a franchise quarterback in two decades is willing to ignore a lot of red flags. That's exactly what this is. I know that, and I think rightfully people are looking at the Dolphins saying, what are you doing? Are you okay taking this baggage on right now? Like, this is a lot going on with Deshaun Watson. And Deshaun Watson, like, what's going on with you? These are a lot of allegations. There's a lot of people involved in this right now. But I also think that at the end of the day, the NFL is a business. The NFL is a business. And the reason that there is always this kind of varying degree of being ostracized that different players have is that if you're really good at your job, a team will find a way to make it work.
Yeah. How I feel about it is I think it's disgusting. Now, Deshaun Watson could be cleared of all charges at some point in time, but until you know that, how on earth can you allow this man not to be on some sort of exempt list? Like, he should be on it immediately. And the fact that he hasn't been on it just continues to go and talk to the hypocrisy of the NFL in every aspect. So, you know, we talked about the whole John Gruden thing and all that, and we agreed. Not appropriate. No room for it, right? And how can you allow this potential situation with Deshaun Watson? Because the Texans aren't necessarily not playing Deshaun Watson because of what's going on in his personal life and all these investigations. They're not playing Deshaun Watson because Deshaun Watson doesn't want to play for the Houston Texans and he's trying to ship himself out of town. And the Miami Dolphins, they trade for him. They're putting him on the field. I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, that's disgusting. That disgusts me. And that, to me, is the reason why I have such a hard time with the NFL. I have a hard time with how they handle these situations. And again, if Deshaun Watson's cleared of all charges, great. Great. Then play him. But until that situation is finalized and you can definitively say that, I don't think he should be touching a football
field.
No, and
I also think it's very fair for someone who has over 20 accusers at this point for people to be looking at it with a lot of hesitation and to be looking at it as a lot of red flags, right? Again, if he's cleared of all charges, good for you. Then, like, you cleared your name. But there, I think there comes a point where, you know, you get 20 accusers in there, and I think it's fair. No one is crossing a line or being cruel by saying, well, wait a minute. That is a lot. That is a lot. So
it is. It's an ugly situation. We haven't talked about it much at all. The 360, innocent until proven guilty. If you have 20 accusers, you're right, innocent until proven guilty. So I don't think that he should go to prison. I don't think that he should be arrested.
No, but you're saying I'm being hesitant right now. I'm looking at it with some question marks.
I'm not letting him touch the field.
Yeah.
I'm not letting him touch the field, because if it turns out that he was able, that he is charged with this, I mean, how can you let that step on the field? No, sorry.
Yeah. Also, I just think that typically the innocent until proven guilty is thrown around in a way to dismiss most often accusers and victims. Like, more often than not, it's not people who really are saying, like, innocent until proven guilty. Like, the law matters. We have to treat everyone fairly. It's usually a way to throw it out, like with the Trevor Bauer thing. Innocent until guilty. And I'm not comparing Bauer and Watson, but I'm saying that when people were throwing that out, I was like, wait a minute. Bunch of Dodgers fans throwing this out. Is it that you really are saying, like, let's let the legal process work out? Or is it that you're saying, leave him alone unless they prove without a shadow of a doubt that he did it?
Right. And that's why I think that you have to be cautious in these situations. And it doesn't mean that he can't come back on the football field when he is proven innocent, or that there is favorable evidence and that they're going through the process. But, I mean, 20 accusers, it's not one, it's not two, and even then they should be treated very, very seriously. We're talking about 20.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a pretty serious situation.
All right, we heard the latest from Jerry DePoto. He was on live this morning with Mike Zalk. He was asked about Mitch Haniger's Player Tribune article. Had a surprising response to that one. He was also asked about free agency. Buster Olney has an article on ESPN about the $1 billion shortstop market that is about to open up. Says the Mariners are a team that's going to be involved there. So we're going to look at all of that at 10:45. Before that, though, a look at the Kraken, who are about to have their home opener, first ever home opener at Climate Pledge Arena. 710 ESPN Kraken insider Andy Ide going to join us next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacy,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
All right, we're going to be joined here in just one moment by 710 ESPN Kraken insider Andy Ide. The Seattle Kraken coming to play their home opener, very first home opener in franchise history. And I was listening to Mike Salk talk about it this morning with Linda Cohn. And Mike summed it up pretty simply. It's been years and years in the making, and it's such an exciting moment for fans to be able to see. So Andy joining us right now. Andy, you went on an arena tour yesterday at Climate Pledge. How was it? Let fans know listening kind of what they're in for here.
It's pretty spectacular, to be honest with you. I guess $1 billion gets you a nice arena. But if you've been to Key Arena before or even the Coliseum, it's going to blow your mind because it's not the same arena. It's completely new. They spared no expense. Everything's nice. And it was really exciting to see. And, you know, they've got a living wall covered in plants. That's pretty cool. I mean, there's a lot of – I mean, you want to get there early, walk around before the game starts.
Now, Andy, from that perspective, is it something that – I mean – I don't necessarily associate, you know, a living plant wall with hockey, but is it something that you just, because it's so grand and it's so cool that it just takes a different shape and feel? Or is it like, no, this outside of that unique aspect of it, this is a hockey arena and this is a pretty darn cool one?
I think once you're in the bowl, you'll feel like this is a hockey arena, but there's a lot of bells and whistles out in the concourses and, you know, there's a lot of clubs. If you like, you know, adult beverages, you're going to be in good hands there. There's a lot of places to go find a drink or food. You know, there's a huge team store in there. So it's like top end, high end and the concourse. But then when you get inside, it looks like a hockey arena.
Now that we're looking at, you know, the arena, it's very exciting. The actual team that's going to be returning to the arena. Have you been a bit surprised by their start to the season?
You know, it's tough to say. That was a tough circumstance they got put into by the schedulers. And part of that was the arena not being ready. But having to play 5 road games in 8 days across 3 time zones, 3 of those games were the other team's season opener. home opener, you know, so that there was that added, you know, extra excitement on that end. And they have some injuries. You know, they got Yanni Gourde back at the end. That's a big deal. But they were missing some guys before that. So, you know, it wasn't great, but it also wasn't the worst thing that could have happened. They got 3 points out of it. You know, and if the playoffs ended today, they're in. So it's still pretty early. I wouldn't worry about things quite yet.
Andy, obviously very, very early on from that perspective. But what is the thing that I would say, what is one thing that's been positive that you see that can turn into something great? And then what is one negative so far to start the season?
Well, a big positive that kind of flies under the radar to me is that we saw, especially later in the trip, that they were really standing up for each other and bonding. You know, like there was somebody took a hit and a Kraken player would come up and challenge the guy who did it, you know, to a fight. And that's just guys sticking up for each other. And that goes really well to building chemistry and team camaraderie. And I think that was kind of a surprise because these guys don't know each other. You know, they're still kind of learning each other, but they didn't hesitate to jump in and help their teammates. That was a positive, I think, that'll pay off down the road as far as chemistry. You know, a negative is I think they made some mistakes, and some of that could just be they haven't had much practice. They didn't practice at all. They didn't have time on the road trip. And you know, you saw things like not covering the neutral zone. You led to a lot of two-on-ones or odd-man rushes the other way. And we saw a little bit of that in Vegas where they just kind of made a little mistake here that led to a chance the other way. And that seemed to be creeping in and becoming kind of a consistent through the road trip.
So you said they weren't able to practice really on the road trip?
Oh, not at all. Yeah, they haven't practiced since they were back here because they were pretty much traveling. They'd have a game and they would travel. They do get a morning skate the day of, but that's not really a practice. It's just more get your legs loose and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's insane. So is there any player that's been a pleasant surprise for you?
You know, I think they picked up that kid, Boulay from Tampa Bay, and he had a great play in the game against Nashville. Helps out the winning goal. You know, he's a guy that we didn't really know much about. He had great numbers in the minor leagues, but then when, you know, he got the few NHL games he played, he hadn't done much. And Tampa released him. Part of that was because of their salary cap issue, but he's been a pleasant surprise. That should add some depth to their forward group.
You know, Andy, one of the things that's been made about it is that they haven't been at full strength yet, right? Not only is there chemistry issues, but they haven't been at full strength. You get Yanni Gourde back for the first time. And Callie, I feel like Marshawn Lynch. I always hesitate at the last name. Yarncroc, you know, he hasn't been back either. And those are two experienced guys that, you know, you're kind of relying on. How big of a deal is it that they haven't really been able to get their feet underneath them and that Cal Yarncroc hasn't even, you know, hit the ice yet?
Yeah, it's a big deal. And it's not just Yarncroc and Gourde who did come back, it's Yarncroc and Colin Blackwell is another center that we haven't seen yet. He's been hurt all training camp, and he is on the ice right now, though, practicing. So we're not sure yet if he's ready to go. But he's a guy who scored 17 goals for the Rangers last year, and is, you know, that's a pace for over 20. That's some more offensive power that they haven't had yet. So when he comes back, when Yarncroc comes back, they also have Marcus Johansson hurt. When all those guys come back, you know, it's going to give them so much more offense on their forwards. So they'll look a lot different.
We may not have completely seen it yet. I mean, I know we've seen kind of shades of it, but as the season progresses, what are fans going to see in terms of what a Dave Hakstol coached Kraken team looks like?
Yeah, I think ultimately they'll be in every game. Every game will be competitive, and we did see a little bit of that on the road trip. You know, I think they'll shore up their defensive. You know, both the forwards and the defense, I think, struggled at times. That's just, you know, like letting teams get through the neutral zone too easy, not getting on the forecheck, making mistakes with the puck. That's not what Dave Hakstol wants. So I think that'll get shored up, and I think practice will be a big part of that. The more they practice, the more they'll get that down and be on the same page and all that stuff. So I think that's what you'll see. You'll see a tight checking game. You know, a lot of close games that'll come down maybe to the end or one play, you know, and that's not necessarily by design, but that's just kind of the roster they have. And, you know, Hakstol's going to want to play things tight and, you know, get the puck deep before check and then play better through the neutral zone.
Andy, that part of it to me is the aspect that I want to see come through. It's not just, you know, as you said, the producing into scoring, but, you know, from a defensive minded team and everyone thinking that that's how they've been built, you know, kind of from the back forward, that they have not been able to live up to that. Andy, from your perspective, how quickly can that change? How fast or how long does it take for a team that hasn't played much together or played much at all together for them to develop that chemistry and trust.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a formula, but I think we're going to find out, right? They're going to have 2 days of practice before they play Vancouver on Saturday, and then we'll have two more days of practice before they play Montreal on Tuesday at home. So I think you know, by those two games, we should see some improvement because they'll have four practices in 6 days, and you better see that kind of improvement because you don't want to go too far down the road, you know, losing games and falling behind the rest of the division in the conference. So. Yeah, you know, I think the more they practice, it's better. I said they just get to know each other better on the ice. They know, you know, they know the system better. And I think we saw a little bit of that, just lack of awareness and chemistry on the road trip. And so hopefully these next 4 or 5 days can help. You know, it's almost like a mini training camp here for the next week. So hopefully that'll help shore up some of those things that are missing, and they'll be on their way.
He is 710 ESPN Seattle Kraken insider Andy Eide. You can read his latest up on 710sports.com right now. Head to the website, hit Kraken on the top of the page, and you can find all of Andy's work. He's got one up called Are the Seattle Kraken Doomed to Struggle on Offense? Don't panic yet. That certainly sounds good. Andy, we look forward to talking to you next week after the Kraken play their home opener. I'm excited.
Yeah, thanks. It'll be fun.
Thanks so much, Andy. Talk to you later. All right. Jerry DePoto was on with Mike Salk this morning, in case you guys missed it. Mike asked him about that article, you guys, that Mitch Haniger wrote in the Players Tribune, where he kind of called out the front office, and it may not have been hostile, but called out the front office.
That gave us all life?
That gave us all life. It was a fantastic article. I think DePoto's response will surprise you guys. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
As a reminder, because it is Thursday, we have a two-hour Seahawks preview. It is The Huddle. Dave Wyman will join us at noon, and we'll get you guys set from noon to 2 p.m. with interviews with some Seahawks players. We'll have special guests. Preview of the Saints, all kinds of good stuff. So again, that starts at noon. Short show for Jake and I today. Let's talk about Jerry DePoto. Jerry DePoto was on with Mike Salk this morning for the Jerry DePoto Show. And one of the first things that Mike asked him was, hey, did you happen to read Mitch Haniger's Players Tribune piece? As a reminder for anyone who didn't see it, we talked about it endlessly. But if you are someone who did not see it, it was a fantastic article. Mitch Haniger talked about taking ownership, how the players and the Mariners take ownership over that playoff drought. He issued a warning for the other teams in the league saying, hey, we're coming for you. We're coming for the World Series. We're coming for the playoffs and more. It got Jake fired up. It got fans fired up. It got everyone fired up.
Oh, man.
In the article, he also said directly a message to the front office. And it was, I'm summarizing this point, but basically I hope the front office is taking note that we're ready and that they're ready to make some moves to help us out. So, obviously, everyone's curious to know what the front office thinks about that message. Salk asked Jerry. Here's what Jerry said.
I did. I loved it. Immediately sent him a text. And yeah, anything that is well thought out, that is heartfelt like that, I believe was heartfelt. That did not come in 30 seconds of reaction or, you know, emotionality. That was a well thought out from the heart piece. And I thought it was incredibly well done. And I thought Mitch gave us a little window into the way he thinks or where his mind is right now. And I thought it was refreshing. And you know, I sent him a simple text. Amazing. You know, I thought it was really well done and it hit the heart. And I agree with him, frankly, on almost everything he said.
I'd love to know what he didn't agree with him on.
Right. Yeah.
But overwhelmingly, I do think it's good to hear Jerry DePoto, the GM of your team, say, yeah, I agree. It's time for us to do stuff this offseason.
Absolutely. And to be 100% on the same page and to feel excited about it enough to immediately send him a text. But I think that when you're talking about Mitch Haniger, what could have been that piece that he may have disagreed with? Maybe it was the idea that he was sitting there on the chopping block at the trade deadline. I mean, I don't know what else, you know, what else Jerry could be thinking going, oh, Mitch, you weren't on the chopping block or whatever. I mean, I don't know, but I don't know what else you could, you know, disagree with or think that about a certain aspect of it. But when you're talking about, you know, Mitch Haniger and setting the tone for the offseason, that's what he did. You know, 2021, as I said, I will always forever love the 2021 Mariners, but The reason why is because it set the stage for right now, set the stage for what 2020 can be, and Mitch Haniger doubling down on that sentiment, on that feeling, and putting it into words, putting it out there for everyone. And that's why I also think it was important that that ownership and John Stanton and Jerry DePoto, as president of baseball operations, also put it out there into words for everyone to hear that, hey, yes, we know that we're going to expand our payroll. We know that we need to be aggressive in order to make our club better. And it's not just going to be one or two moves. It's going to be a flurry of moves that we have to make in order to make this thing happen and in order for us to be a 90-plus win team on a consistent basis that's going to go to the playoffs and consist or contend for a World Series someday. Like, there needs to be – now there are the words. Now there is the tone set, Stacey. Now you need to see action. You need to see action take place. And we are all here in Seattle just like, okay, when is this World Series going to be over? Soon as that thing is done, now things get really kicked off in terms of, are they going to follow through on their words?
Well, they have a lot of decisions to make as well. For instance, a couple days after the World Series, that's the deadline to decide whether they want to exercise that four-year extension on Yusei Kikuchi.
Nope.
They also have a decision to make about whether or not they want to extend Mitch Haniger. After this article came out, I think people were fairly thinking, well, it sounds like Mitch wants to stay here. It sounds like he's pretty dedicated to it. Jerry DePoto was also asked by Mike, what's your level of confidence Haniger wants to be here long-term?
I've never not had hope that Mitch wants to be here long-term. I believe that he enjoys playing here. I know he loves the city, and I know he loves his teammates. This is it's a very close team emotionally. If I did have a sense as to whether an extension was possible, I wouldn't air it on the radio this morning, but I've always had the belief that this is where Mitch wants to be. And if that works out and we're able to come together on it somewhere down the road, then that'll be a wonderful outcome for both of us.
Now, I think the thing that is important, the word that he used, the phrasing to hold on to, is hope. Jerry DePoto doesn't know. Jerry DePoto also isn't very clear or sure as to what Mitch Haniger is thinking and where that relationship currently resides, but is hopeful that Mitch Haniger is going to want to stay here. And there's a lot of factors as to why Haniger would want to stay here. His teammates, he mentioned, I think that, the city, the fan base, and all of that. But the question remains, does he have the overall belief of what they're going to do? And that article that Mitch Haniger put out there, I think, answered all of those questions. So if Mitch Haniger really truly believes that, what has to happen? Is there anything more that has to happen for him to feel like, I want to sign an extension here? Is he going to hold out through the offseason until he sees the moves that are made?
I think that could be a possibility.
Oh, yeah. I would not expect a Haniger extension to be done, if it does get done, until some point in the 2022 season.
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible that even the guys within this team, before deciding about their own long-term feelings, want to see Seattle commit to them as well. Because you can be as emotionally invested in the success of your team as you want, but if you feel like the people at the top aren't, then that's going to give you pause. And right now, I think plenty of people, I think rightfully, have a feeling like, look, Jerry DePoto, John Stanton have made it clear that they're going to spend and they want to spend and they want to make the team better. But I think knowing that is different than feeling that it's happening. And I understand that that's a two-step or multi-step process for a lot of people, which is why Buster Olney's article this morning in ESPN is fascinating. He talks about the billion-dollar free agent shortstop class that's going to be happening. You've got, obviously, Carlos Correa, Corey Seager, Marcus Semien, Trevor Story, Javi Baez, that are all going to be free agents for potential landing spots. And Buster Olney lists the Mariners as, and I don't love this, a, quote, sneaky presence in the free agent market this winter. I would hope they're a lot more than a sneaky presence. I would hope they're like a pounding fist on the table. Hey, we're
loud.
Here to spend.
Yes.
Yeah, I hope they're making
I hope their presence
big,
is made known.
As Cardi B would say, money moves.
I like it.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, it has to be that way, right? And there's no excuse. I mean, ultimately, if players don't want to come here, there's nothing you can do about that outside of throwing them a bunch of money, right? And so you...
Then throw them a bunch of money.
I know. And Scott Servais, on our last show here, as before he went off into the sunset, and we won't see him again until next year.
Do you think he misses us?
Sometimes, yeah. I do. I really think that on Tuesdays, he's like, man, really, really miss those guys. But yeah. Despite that, he knows. He's like, hey, if we're going to get these guys, we got to throw a whole bunch of money at them. He said it on our show. So they're not naive to that idea. It's just how much are they willing to go? Mm-hmm. How much, when it comes down to the negotiating table, do they sit there and say, you know, they're holding up the paddle. Yes, I'm gonna keep increasing until they get to that final point.
Well,
and how many times are they going to be willing to do that? That's going to be the big question. And how many superstars do you go after versus, you know, second, third tier players that you think can legitimately contribute for you and give you big league at-bats and contribution?
Well, and I know the Mariners know this, but you're almost working with a different currency here. Like, you are going to have to overspend because you don't have the championships to show people. You don't even have – you have lots of promise with your farm system, but other guys, other players haven't seen it yet. So if you can't prove to guys, hey, we're going to be in a World Series here, even if you believe that, then you're going to need to spend, and you're going to need to overspend, and you're going to need to spend more than the Dodgers in terms of like what the Dodgers would be able to offer someone. The Dodgers are clearly willing to spend, but it is easier for a player to be convinced to go to a team he knows can win a championship that season than to a team that hasn't done it but feels that they can. So the Mariners are going to need to overspend on a few of these, and I sure hope they're willing to, because otherwise I don't know that any of these deals are getting done.
They got the payroll for it.
All right. Coming up in the timeline, some awesome audio from Matt Hasselbeck on the story of getting the Panthers to shift on defense. It was a really, really cool story from the 06 NFC Championship game. That's coming up at 11:30. We've also got Four Down Territory, some great X's and O's questions there. But there's another X's and O's conversation I want to have coming up next. A fascinating quote from Robert Saleh has us wondering whether the league has caught up to the Seahawks. That's next.